Welcome to another episode of the Rugby Buzz, a brand new podcast brought to you by H&HB Events. My name is Mark Hartery, and I'll be your host as I chat to rugby stars past and present about matches that they played in or were involved in that remain highlights for them. Today, I'm delighted to be able to chat to former Gloucester Rugby back row forward, Pete Glanville. Pete joined Gloucester from local side Longlevens and made his debut in 1992. He played 143 times for Gloucester, scoring an impressive 20 tries. He was captain of the club for the season 97-98, before injury sadly cut short his career. He was appointed team manager at King's Home under Philippe Saint-André, before becoming head coach at Cinderford, taking them into National League One for the first time in their history. Pete now spends his time as the managing director of the Water Coolers Direct Group in Gloucestershire. So, hello, Pete. Welcome to the Rugby Buzz. How are you doing?
Yeah, all good. Thanks, Mark. All good. Nice to be on board.
Yeah, great to chat to you. Now, you've picked a great game back from 1995 for us to chat about today. But first, I just wanted to ask you about the day job, really. And as MD of Water Coolers Direct Group, how are things in the world of hydration?
I think, like most companies, challenging. We have gone through tough times. You know, there's no hiding that. But we're going to come out stronger. We're a little bit leaner, unfortunately. But the opportunities out there in our industry, hydration. I know catering and retail are being hit hard.
Yeah.
But there's still plenty of opportunity for us. We're focusing on providing for the home, whether that's a boiling hot tap or a chill tap. And, you know, we've been very fortunate all through COVID because we deal with a lot of hospitals and care homes as well. We have worked all the way through it. So we've definitely been in a better place than most, albeit still very challenging. And I think the biggest challenge is the future is still uncertain.
Yeah, definitely.
And so for it doesn't matter what company, what industry, you know, it's very difficult to try and plan for the future when you're not sure what the future might hold.
Yeah, you've got to have plan A, B, C, and so on. Haven't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you just don't know what it looks like. And of course, the other thing that you guys are really passionate about is you know, stopping the single use plastic.
Yeah, and again, unfortunately, you know, thanks to all the efforts of David Attenborough, it was really gathering momentum. COVID's come along, and it's kind of forced people back to single use because of the cross contamination. Yeah. So there has been a big increase back to single use. But, you know, as the world starts to return back to normality, we're still very, very focused on banned single use. We've got some really good products coming to market for banning single use, whether that's a bottle for life. We're still fully aware that there is going to be a requirement for people just to grab a bottle to go. Yeah. And we're going to be launching a new product online very soon, ReWater, which is a fully recyclable aluminium bottle with an aluminium twist top that can be reused a number of times. And then, of course, with it being recycled aluminium, can carry on being recycled as many times as possible.
Wow, that's fantastic. So that's exciting news. So we'll watch out for that.
And I think many companies, not just in our game, but throughout, have to look to diversify and look at, you know, the bigger picture now.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, we'll watch out for that with bated breath, Pete. So for your favourite game, as I say, you're taking us back to 1995, the 11th of March 1995, a soaking wet King's Home.
Yes.
That's nothing new, is it? But when Northern Transvaal were the visitors, and I think that season Gloucester had already played Canterbury from New Zealand. So how did those games come about?
I think, you know, first of all, I chose that. I was very fortunate enough to play amateur and professional down at King's Home. But I think that particular game was one game that stood out. A, obviously because of some of the personnel that were playing for Northern Transvaal. And obviously latter that year, they went on to win the World Cup, South Africa. How it come about, I think the powers that be, Gloucester, were just fortunate to be talking to the right people. And you know, as you say, Canterbury were touring, Transvaal were touring. I'm sure if you asked Transvaal after the match, they wish they hadn't bothered, given the conditions, and it was their last game of the tour. But, you know, a great experience for us and, you know, something different for the supporters.
Yeah, and I think, you know, touring sides, I remember standing on terraces for touring games, you know, right across back when I was in South Wales and again at Gloucester. And, you know, they were special. It's a real shame that there's no real place for that in the pro game. Do you think that can be shoehorned in somehow?
I think it's very difficult with the number of games these players are playing nowadays. You know, a touring game is a non-pressure game, and that's where you generally see some great rugby. And you know, the conditions were awful that day, but both teams were still trying to play open running rugby rather than, you know, the kicking game that you see so much nowadays. And you can understand it because the pressure's on. Whereas when you play a touring team, you know, there is no pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, it's a fantastic game to watch, and the Northern Transvaal time. And we'll talk about some of their personnel in a sec, but, you know, it's great for the supporters to see some of these stars of world rugby playing on their own patch.
Massively. And I think at the time it was also good for us as players. I mean, you know, we were very fortunate. We had Mike Teague and Ian Smith, two, you know, internationals in their own right, in our team. But, you know, you don't very often get to play Southern Hemisphere teams. So it was a fantastic opportunity for us.
Yeah. And you touched on, obviously, it was just at the end of the amateur era before the 95 World Cup later in the year. What would the Gloucester build-up have been, given that it was still amateur? What would have happened? It would have been a normal week? You work during the day and training in the evening?
Exactly, and on a Thursday, a flag and a cider after training.
Only one.
All the true preparation.
Yeah, good, good,
but,
good.
I mean, you know, look, we were very, very fortunate, I think. Anybody that's been able to experience amateur and professional, and you know, in some respects, amateur was probably a little bit more difficult because you did have to fit your training around a daytime job. You know, whether that involved getting up earlier in the morning to do your fitness training, go to work for the day, and then have a team run in the evening.
What job were you doing at that stage?
I was actually working for my father's company. So I was a commercial tire fitter and retreader.
Wow.
So basically getting very dirty every single day.
Yeah. And I'm
not,
sure he
not quite as colourful as Deeks's Drayman,
no,
but you know, needs must back then.
Yeah, and I'm sure he was. I'm sure Dad was very flexible in terms of your training as well.
He was, and that was the one, you know, the one benefit. And you know, I wasn't too upset when the game turned professional. I was given that opportunity to get out of overalls and into some clean sports kit.
Yeah, exactly. On the day itself, what was the typical routine for Gloucester? What, you know, how often, how soon did you meet up, and you know, what happened?
You know, typically if it was a 3 o'clock kickoff, we'd probably meet at 1 o'clock. Sometimes we'd have met at the Farmers Club and walked down. I'm sure on that day we didn't due to the weather conditions, and we met direct at the club. Team talk initially, and then you were into sort of like pretty much your own personal preparation.
Okay. And was there, you know, in the amateur days, you see these the pro sides going out and doing extensive warm-ups and so on. What was the what was the amateur warm-up like?
And that was still very much, you know, we had our own coach. We still had sort of like a fitness coach, so we were still very much going out pre-match warming up, We had physios on hand for strapping and preparation. So, you know, that side of things, obviously it's got far more professional now, but the basis of your match were still very much like it is today.
And of course, it's still the same today, but that just before you went back into the changing rooms, that run in front of the shed, what's that like?
It's one of the best feelings in the world. You know, you have to say, you know, there are some games when you might not necessarily be as mentally focused for the match because of other things going on in and around your private life. But the one thing that would always get you tuned in was that jog around the pitch in front of the shed before the kickoff. You know, I've yet to speak to a player that wasn't energized by that.
Yeah, and glad to see it still happens as well.
Oh, definitely.
Even in this era. So the Gloucester side that you had at that day was just jam packed full of local rugby players, wasn't it? I mean, looking at the side, if I just kind of run through it, you had the late Martin Speedy Roberts at fullback. Paul Holford, Don Caskey, Lee Osborne, Simon Morris. You had halfbacks Martin Kimber and Bruce Fenley. Then you had the legendary front row of Tony Window, Johnny Hawker and Deeks, Dave Sims and Simon Devereux in the second row, and then yourself with Ian Smith and Teague in the back row. That's quite a side, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, we were very proud that we were all local back then. And you know, again, I was very fortunate to play in the back row with the likes of Teague and Smithy. I learned so much from them over the years. And as you say, you know, you touched on the late Martin Roberts, Speedy Roberts. And this game, I think, also stood out to me because you obviously had, you know, the late world great Yousef Van Westhuizen, who sadly passed away. But, you know, more locally, you have Martin Roberts, who was a massive, massive figure for Gloucester Rugby Club for many years.
Yeah, yeah. And as I say, you're looking back at the programme for it, and you just look at those names and you just think, you know, wow, as you say, all local lads and all getting the chance to play at King's Own. With you know, against these world stars, and the Northern Transvaal team, as you say, Yousef Van der Westhuizen was there at scrum half. You were up against Ruben Krieger, you know, who also was part of the, and again also has sadly passed away. And then you had, you know, Adrian Richter, who was captain that day. You had Bram van Straten, I think, who was on the bench. And in the second row, you had a certain Johan Ackerman.
Yes.
I don't know whatever happened to him.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I do remember about the side is just the pure physical presence they had, and Johan, you know, to this day, you know, he's just recently moved on from leading Gloucester, but even back then, he was such a man mountain and a physical presence on the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as you say, he still is today. I remember we worked with him not long before he left, and he walked into the room through double doors, and he just completely filled them.
Yeah,
he's just huge. And as I say, you look back at the game, and you know, that was the thing coming across to me when I rewatched the game, was just how physical that, you know, that game was. You say about playing good rugby, but it was soaking wet, but it was such a physical game, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, and you know, I'm sure last game of the tour for them, they were looking to just sort of like roll up, put 50 points on us and jump on a plane and back home they go. But, you know, Gloucester being Gloucester, we were a proud team and we really wanted to prove a point that we could match them. I think we were pretty sore and weary after the game.
Yes.
But, you know, I think we did match them for a large part of it. But in the end, you know, their physicality just got the better of us.
Yeah, as you say, I mean, right throughout the game, really, it was just nip and tuck. You'd score, they'd score, they'd go ahead, you'd pull back. The first half had a great start with, you know, free kick in their 22, and what looks like a set play, a mismove, and then this young number six comes smashing through off the mismove and straight through the defence and scores. Talk us through that.
Wasn't it a free kick on the halfway line? I'm sure it was.
Yeah, actually, now you mention. I meant to say you're 22. you're 22. I think yes, not their 22.
Again, you talk about getting into a game and to be able to pretty much fall over the line and score a try early on just gives you a massive confidence booster.
Yeah. It looked like a set play. Was it a set play?
It was a move that we had done many a time, sort of like a couple of dummy runners, then just popped me out wide. And, you know, I think we were just fortunate we caught them napping a little bit. And, you know, it was almost like the gate had opened up for me because I don't think anybody even got their hand on me.
No, they didn't. It was, knife through butter. It was, they were all looking at each other as you ghosted through. But, a great start and, that galvanized them a little bit. There was an interception, I think, that got them back in the game. Yeah. And, you know, half time, they go in just ahead 16-13. And of course, again, I might be wrong, but again, in the amateur era, it's hammering down with rain. I don't think you go into the changing rooms, do you? Half time?
No, we didn't. And that is, that is one thing that really stood out to me compared to nowadays. And you think, Christ, standing out, you're cold and wet playing, and then you stand around for 10 minutes getting cold, still in the cold and wet. So it is quite unbelievable, and in fact, recently watched it again just to remind myself of the game. Even the commentators commented on how the RFU won't let you go into the change room at half time, and if ever there was an occasion to get in the change room, it was that match.
Yeah, definitely. And nowadays, as you say, they go into changing rooms. If it's raining, they have a change of shirt and bits and pieces.
Warm bath.
You just carried on. So, that makes the whole thing just even more amazing, doesn't it?
It is. And also, you look back on it now, you had both teams wearing the heavy cotton shirts that were, three times heavier when they were wet. it really is. And actually, it's great to watch to see just how far the game has progressed now and just how professional it's become now, both on and off the pitch, and also, with the kit available and being utilised now.
Mm, yeah. And the second half, again, followed the same pattern as the first, didn't it? It was very close. It was nip and tuck. And as I said earlier, very physical. At the forefront of that physicality from the South Africans was undoubtedly Johan, and it just reminded me how much he likes a fight.
Well, yes, I mean, some might say he was a little bit too much at the forefront, having to leave the pitch early on that day.
Yes, I think he had a. I don't think the cameras caught it too well. It's a pity we didn't have the replays we get today. But him and Dave Sims had a little altercation in the centre of the field, didn't they?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. That incident. I'm fairly certain. I think I might have taken the ball into contact, or I'd made a tackle, or I remember something, and Dave was basically looking out for me. Johan come in with his probably size 13 feet, and perhaps he wasn't quite as careful as he should have been with them. Yeah. Dave grabbed him, and Johan saw a flash of red, and his head moved in the wrong direction.
Yes,
shall we say? I think that was a massive testament, in a way, to how we were matching them physicality-wise, because that was just through sheer frustration that would have happened. So, in some ways, it was a mark of respect, Should
yeah, definitely.
Say.
Had it been a walk in the park for them, then there would have been no need for that. But you were obviously getting under the skin and so on. And again, remarkably, in these days without TMOs and so on, it was spotted, I think, by the touch judge and Jeff Warren gave a red card. That, you know, so many times in the amateur era pre TMO, those things would have just got missed, wouldn't they?
Yeah, as indeed did the awarded try that wasn't a try as well. strangely enough, I caught up with Bruce Fenley this week on business just for coffee, and I was chatting that I was meeting up with you, and we talked about that game. And the first thing he said was, "That was never a try."
No, he was because he was a tackler, wasn't he?
He was the tackler that held him up.
It was quite a scene. You know, Ackerman gets his marching orders and he traipses off, and again it just reminds you of he walks across and I think his shirt is just absolutely ripped to pieces from the altercation, and he just trudges off, and you know how many of that crowd in 95 would have thought he'd be back with Gloucester a little while later and taking them forward like he did. But
massive.
And as you say, it seemed to galvanise the South Africans, didn't it? They going down to 14 men, they became even more physical and almost seemed to go up a gear, which again is testament to Gloucester. But as you touched on, you know, their winning try, you know, wasn't a try, was it? It wasn't grounded.
And again, it sort of like brings it home to you just how difficult back then it would have been for, you know, the referee and the touch judges. You know, when you look at the way things are managed nowadays, you have, you know, angles, every single angle of the pitch, there's a camera, you know, as you say, you've got a TMO, they're all mic'd up, whereas back then, you know, the referee wasn't even mic'd up to the linesman.
No, that's right. And again, it was a bit of a bundle into touch. So I think the linesman, you know, is immediately trying to get out of the way, rather than look what's happening. The referee was a bit obscured, but he gives the try. As I say, in these days, TMO, you know, there is no way that would have been a try. So do you feel hard done by that? Did Gloucester
rob? No, not really. I mean, I'm sure at the time we were very frustrated, but at the end of the day, they deserved the win. I think it would have been more fitting had the score been sort of like a 3 points away rather than the sort of like 10 it was or whatever. But you know, we gave it our best shot, and we were very proud with our performance.
Yeah, it was a. As you say, it was a great occasion. And what happens after the game with the touring side? Is there any meal or do you get together?
It was quite interesting, actually, because, you know, in true Gloucester fashion, you know, we like to have a bit of a social after a game back then. And whether it was because it was the last game of the tour, they weren't actually that sociable. I think the thought of a long flight early the next morning back home probably put them off any idea of having a late one that night.
Okay, that's a bit disappointing, I guess, but I'm sure you guys made up for it.
Oh, we always make up for it, or we always did make up for it. You know that, Mark. And you know, once you'd gone out the infamous Gloucester bath with your flagon of cider again, and you know, got changed into your blazer and tie, and had something to eat, then it was all about the barrel of Toby that was always laid on after the game.
Oh, happy days.
Yes.
And did you, did you manage to get your hands on any souvenirs or shirts or bits and pieces from that game? Or did that not happen?
I don't think that happened even, no. You know, as I say, when you look at the state of the shirts we come off in, not that you would have recognised any of it anyway, but back then it was kind of very much, I don't think Gloucester would have approved us giving our playing shirts away.
No.
And, Transvaal again, probably very similar because it was the amateur days. So you kind of had one or maybe two sets of shirts that had to last you the season.
Yes. Yeah. Of course, you forget that, don't you? You forget that. Yeah. You know, that it's, as I say, it's, you've ripped that shirt, Pete. What are we going to do? We're going to get another one. But of course, you forget that. I mean, it was a great day. And you went on to have quite a few more seasons at Gloucester. You were captain in the 97-98 season. Then, of course, got to lift the short-lived C&G Cup, I think, against Bedford. So that must have been quite an honour to be captain.
Yeah, massive honour for me. I mean, Richard Hill was in charge. The game had turned professional. When Richard appointed me as club captain, it was one of the proudest moments in my life. To run out, it's a special time. Any time you get to run out on King's Home, but to actually be able to run out and lead the team for a season at King's Home was fantastic for me.
Yeah, and of course, injury brought your career to an abrupt end. What was the injury that kind of finally did it for you, Pete?
I have many along the way, Mark.
Yes, I know. Was there one in particular?
Some would say I was more in the physio room than I was on the pitch. But it was actually my knee in the end. I had already had one ACL reconstruction and probably four or five cartilage operations on the same knee. And unfortunately, in 99, I think it was, it went again. And I can remember, again, our club doctor, the late Rob, recently passed away, sitting me down and saying, have you ever thought about what you're going to do post-rugby? And it come as a complete, as you do as a rugby player, you kind of, okay, I'm injured, I get back playing, and, you know, it's just a matter of time. And Rob sat me down and said, no, it really isn't a matter of time this time. You know, that's it for you.
Wow.
So, yeah, you kind of go into a bit of a dark place then.
Yeah. And what I was going to say, Pete, just on that, we chat to rugby guys all the time and lots who have finished. And, that's a huge thing, isn't it? If you can plan it and say, oh, I'm going to finish when I'm 34 or this or that. But when injury comes and it comes, that's a huge thing for people and professional sports people these days to deal with, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think the problem's getting worse, that, the game's getting more and more physical. Guys are bigger and stronger. They're turning professional sports people almost straight from school or university. Yeah. So to have their careers cut short by injury, they've almost been a class that is institutionalized.
Yes,
in the professional era, you're told what to wear, you're told what time to be, where to be, what to eat, how to behave. And if you're coming straight from a university background, that's all you've ever known. Yeah. You then pick up an injury and all of a sudden, you're in the real world and nobody's telling you what to do anymore. You've got to suddenly try and work that out for yourself.
Yeah. And people listening will say, "Oh, that can't be that," but it is. It's institutionalized, isn't it? As you say, people tell you what to, as you say, what to eat, what time to be there, what to wear, what to do this, what to do that, and then suddenly, almost abruptly, nobody's doing that, and it's a huge culture shock.
It is, and you look at that. There's a lot of a lot of big names that have recently released books. I think Dylan Hartley's been the latest one, and that mental side of it is very much featured in that. What happens post rugby? You spend your whole life wanting to play professional rugby. You're fortunate enough to play at whatever standard, and you take that on in the likes of Dylan and Phil Vickery and those guys that have played the highest level achievable. Yeah. And then the next day you wake up and you have to think, what next?
Yeah, yeah, Do you think there's enough support in the professional game for that?
I definitely think it's getting a lot better. It's also, you know, it's also difficult because the players live in the dream. You know, the players in the bubble, the players live in the dream. And, you know, as much as you have the support around you, you know, if you choose not to listen, if you choose not to take it, then it is very difficult. I think it is getting a lot better. I think more and more clubs now are understanding the impact of what happens to a rugby player when they finish their career, and are definitely trying to support the player that much more.
Good. Yeah, well, let's hope it continues. And, you know, as you say, particularly the mental health side, I think, you know, with what's happened over the last 6 months with COVID and everything else, I think that's a crucial thing. And, yes, you know, about men talking and all of that. But
yeah,
I think we do need that level of support as well.
Yeah.
I mean, after you finished, you then became a team manager. So how did that come about?
Very, very fortunate. Philip Saint-André was at the helm when I finished. John Brain, again, another fantastic, you know, Gloucester legend who's unfortunately passed away. John Brain was forwards coach. And Ken Nottage approached me and said, is it something I'd be interested in? I hadn't really given it a lot of thought. And, you know, instantly I was kind of like, I would love to be team manager. Mm. Didn't know what it entailed, but what I did know is it kept me within the team atmosphere. I suddenly had to do a lot of learning very fast when somebody gave me a laptop and said, right, there you go, there's the budget, work that out.
Wow.
As we spoke earlier, I was a very much a hands-on person pre-rugby, to then go in, you know, all about the physical side of things, to suddenly have to sit in front of a laptop and, you know, read contracts and book hotels and airports and travel arrangements. It was a pretty steep learning curve. And all the time, you had a very, very hard taskmaster in Philip Saint-André for numerous reasons. Mm. And also, you know, when I look back on that, you had Philippe, who was given head coach, who had also just walked off a rugby pitch was taking up the helm. So he was very inexperienced as well. So we were both learning our trade at the same time.
Enjoyable time though, Pete?
It was enjoyable, massively enjoyable. You're still involved in the professional sport and a sport that, you know, you loved even before it turned professional. It's never quite the same as playing. I don't think it will ever take that away. You kind of get, when you're a player and you have a great win, you want to go out and celebrate it. When you're on the coaching stroke management side, it's more of a relief.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, and again, you know, people don't necessarily think about that, do they?
No, exactly. When you're playing and you go over that white line, and I don't care whether you're an amateur or professional, nobody goes over the white line to have a bad game. Everybody wants to be the hero of a match, and unfortunately, it doesn't happen sometimes. And again, that then mounts the pressure on the management. So every time, you know, the team loses, there's a little bit more pressure on the backroom staff and the coaching staff.
Yeah, yeah. Do you, obviously, you've got your day job and so on. Is there a part of you that misses that involvement with rugby at that level?
I certainly don't miss the playing anymore.
No.
Apart with the physicality and watching some of the hits that go in nowadays. I think there's always a part that you secretly miss it. I do think players nowadays need to understand better that there is a crossover from professional sport into business and the real world. And they just need to understand how to access those core skills that they've learned through professional sport and put it into a business environment.
Mm. You're heavily involved in business very successfully. Is that something business can help with in terms of being a bit more proactive with some of these players around the country?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think there are a lot of companies out there that would love to have the opportunity to sponsor players. But when I say sponsor, that's with regards to give the player an opportunity to come into work and start to understand what it is they might like to do post-rugby. Because one thing's for certain, you know, it doesn't pay as well as footballers. You do live a kind of rock star lifestyle while you're in the bubble, but very often it's not enough that you can just put your feet up post rugby. You know, you've still got to find alternative employment when you finish rugby. Yeah. And probably only the top 3 or 4% in the game are fortunate enough to carry on earning, you know, a good living through rugby. Everybody else will generally either completely leave rugby or have to do something to supplement it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same with our kids growing up and work experience. As you said, a lot of these guys now, particularly with the structure, have come through academies and then straight into rugby. They wouldn't have experienced different jobs. But that almost that work experience is great at telling people what they don't want to do as what they do want to do, isn't it? And the more they do that, that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, I always tell a very funny story about Pete Buxton.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Bucko, very good friends with Pete. And, again, that we spoke very much when he was coming to the end of his career. I was already in business and I wanted to help him. And we sat down for coffee and he said, you know, I've got it all sussed. I'm going to be an electrician.
Yeah.
And I kind of had a smile and, you know, I said, Bucko, hold your hands up. And, you know, there wasn't a straight finger on his hand. You know, they were going in all directions. And I was like, well, how long do you think you're going to be able to wire a plug for?
Yeah.
And we kind of had a laugh. But again, you know, even back then, you know, Bucko was thinking about post-rugby.
Yeah.
Because he had you know, the amateur side of things, whereas guys nowadays don't get exposed to that.
No.
So, and again, you touched on it earlier, it's all about talking. You know, I'm sure deep down, you know, the player of today is nervous about what happens post-rugby, and that's where, you know, they shouldn't be scared to talk to people and get some experience about what they might like to do later in life.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, to any, you know, business owners and so on that may be listening to this podcast, that's a perfect opportunity. If you can, you know, can get involved with your local sides, your local pro sides, then, you know, there must be some opportunities there that work for both of them.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I still get down King's Omar. I speak to Lance and Alex Brown on a regular basis, and it is very much top of their agenda as well. Good. You know, it's it is tough times, and particularly tough times for sports clubs, whether you're amateur or professional at the moment. But, you know, they are very much aware of looking after the players' welfare, both on the pitch and off the pitch.
Good. Yeah, that's fantastic to hear, and long may that continue. Pete, it's been fascinating to catch up with you. A great game that you picked, but probably the kind of ancillary chat really about you know what happens after people stop playing. I've very much enjoyed that. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast, and we'll speak to you again at some point in the future. Pete,
great,
very much.
Thank you, Mark. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the Rugby Buzz as much as we are in putting them together. If you do like them, please do leave us a review and share with your fellow rugby fans. As you know, things are difficult for live events right now, and we do hope to be back with you in 2021 when we already have some dates in the diary. On February the 3rd, we have our annual Rugby Dinner of the Year with none other than Sir Bill Beaumont at the Hatherley Manor Hotel and Spa in Gloucestershire. On March the 8th, we have an evening with Nigel Owens at the Huntingdon Hall Theatre in Worcester. And then we have two evenings with former Lions captain Sam Warburton in South Wales. Don't forget, 2021 is a Lions year, so there'll be lots of things to discuss there. We have April the 13th at the Princess Royal Theatre in Port Talbot. And then on April the 21st, we're at the Memo Arts Centre in Barry. All the details and tickets can be found on our website, which is www.hnhb.buzz. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to bringing you another exciting episode every week. Stay safe.